Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Chad here, your hosts for this weekend show. And this weekend show, we're going to go back to focusing on precious metals in the first half of the show and the energy sector in the back half of the show. The last few weeks, we really took more of a generalist view on the markets. For anyone that missed those interviews, I definitely recommend you listen to those weekend shows because, again, it was more a broad look at markets and where investors were positioning. And quite frankly, markets, wow, they have rebounded very, very quickly. And the S&P even hit all-time highs again this week. That being said, this weekend show, precious metals, kicking off with Jeff Christian. Jeff is the managing partner at the CPM Group. And Jeff, as I said, price action-wise, markets, they're back to all-time highs. Precious metals, gold and silver, they're still in the middle of very wide ranges. Gold, a little bit, I guess, closer to those all-time highs. Well, silver, it's climbing back too, but that spike high up to 121 is still quite a way away from current prices. So I guess the most important question here, Jeff, is what's your view on the precious metals markets and where price goes?
Yeah, we've been telling our clients for several weeks that we thought that the prices would move sideways in a consolidation phase, but in a very wide range. So for gold, we've been saying, you know, $4,100 to $4,850. And we did see $4,100 briefly at the end of March, and we saw $4,861 today. So we stayed in that range. And from a ultra short-term perspective, we think that range continues to hold. You know, we're testing the top of it, but we think there's a lot of resistance and a lot of investor profit-taking around 4,900. So we think that the price will probably continue to move sideways, and we're telling our ultra short-term clients to stand aside still, with the idea that the prices ultimately will rise longer. Now, from a slightly longer term perspective, you know, we've been equivocating between two main scenarios. One is that the prices move into this extended consolidation phase from April through August, you know, the seasonal weakness that you tend to see in the second and third quarters. And then the alternative that we've been studying is, given the state of the world, economically, politically, internationally, domestically, do the prices just keep rising because investors are so worried? We're now leaning toward the idea of a extended consolidation period where we see the gold price trade between, you know, primarily maybe 4,400 or 4,200 and $5,000, $5,200 for the next several months. You know, that may be more likely with continued volatility. And you know, a similar pattern in silver. We were saying that we thought the price could trade between $62 and $80. It broke above $80 today. As with gold, you're seeing a lot of resistance around these levels. You do have the May COMEX roll coming up over the next 2 weeks. That could push the price up briefly. But we think that by and large, we're probably going to see an extended consolidation period in the second and third quarters with higher prices later as we approach the congressional elections in the United States and as economic conditions continue to deteriorate and as political problems, both domestically and internationally, continue to deteriorate. So that's our outlook for those two metals.
Well, Jeff, this week we also had a big report come out from the Silver Institute that's getting sent around the internet. It's on Twitter. It's being used by different platforms to pick it up. And the point they're making is that it's a sixth consecutive year of a silver deficit. The things that they're pointing to in there are two big points. And we talked about this off mic a little bit. I'd love you to make some of the same points to our audiences. Just the hedging that they're looking at from producers is one data point. The other data point is the investment angle making up the deficit. And they're including not just fabrication demand and industry, but they're also including bars and coins in there. A lot of people are curious why bars and coins shouldn't count as demand. You look at it a little differently at the CPM Group. Maybe break down how you would view those data points from the Silver Institute?
Yeah, without going into details, those are two areas where the Silver Institute's data, like the World Gold Council's data, are methodologically inaccurate. And I won't bore you with the details, including forward sales by producers, but excluding forward purchases by fabricators and forward transactions by anybody else as a source of spot physical supply is an inaccuracy. Forward sales do not involve spot physical sales. They are hedged by the hedging service provider. They are hedged in the forward market, the futures market, the options market, and nowadays, in the last 20 years, also by ETFs and ETF options. So there's no physical metal involved in those hedges. But back in the 89-90 period, the World Gold Council said that no, this is the way it is. And even though their members said no, it's not, they have persisted for 35 years to say that. So the Silver Institute data has like a 44 million ounce of additional physical spot sales last year due to hedging. And that's supply that didn't occur. It didn't happen. And then their investment demands are kind of all over the place, and that causes their deficits to be crazy. So they had this 318 million ounce deficit, 217 million ounces of investment demand. So they had a 100 million ounce deficit, not a 318 million ounce deficit. But what you asked, which is very important, is why don't you include investment demand in with fabrication demand? And it's very important to use the terminology. Fabrication demand, there used to be an organization called the Silver Users Association. It wasn't the Silver Consumers Association, it was the Silver Users Association. Fabrication demand is legally defined as something when you take a raw material and you use it in a manufactured product, the value of which increases more than 3% of the value of the raw material. So coins and co bullion coins and bullion bars, generally speaking, are manufactured products, as is any refined metal. It's manufactured from the ore, right, or the scrap, but it's not a fabricated product. And it's very important because of several things. First off, people who buy fabricated products are buying products, jewelry or silverware or electronic goods or an automobile with silver in it. And they're buying that manufactured product as that manufactured product, that fabricated product. People who buy bars and coins are buying gold and silver as an investment. And legally, an investment activity is defined as buying, holding, and selling. And investors buy and they sell. So that stuff stays in gold and silver form, refined form. It is readily available to be sold should anybody that holds it ever want to sell it. Now, the silver stackers say, we're not investors, we'll never sell. But legally, they're investors. Let's not talk about what their heirs will do when they die. So there's a very big distinction between fabricated products that have value added much higher than the value of the gold and silver contained, and the motives of the buyers and holders of fabricated products and investment demand. And you want to disaggregate those two because the investment products can and do sometimes come back to the market. Our estimate is that over the last 5 years, as much as 950 million to a billion ounces of silver have been sold on a gross basis by investors over the last 5 years. Now, investors were also buying about 327 million ounces on a net basis based on our data. If you use the Silver Institute's data, it's 1.3 billion ounces. Our data is 327 because we take out that gross sales. We say, okay, maybe gross purchases were 1.3 million billion ounces over the last 5 years, but there was both gross sales by other investors of a billion ounces. So net investment demand over the last 5 years, by our estimate, is about 327 million ounces. Big difference. So you want to separate and segregate investment demand and refined gold and silver bars and coins from fabrication demand, where the stuff is used in manufactured products that aren't going to be resold for their silver value because the price of silver rises or falls. I think that's the main thing. The other thing is that if you look at the economics of them, fabrication demand is negatively correlated with the price. As the gold or silver price rises, fabrication demand tends to fall. And if the price falls, as it did from 1980 to 1990, 1995, 2000, you'll see fabrication demand rise. It's negatively correlated to the price of gold or silver. Investment demand is positively correlated. So as you see the price rising, investors buy more. They race into the firehouse. Investment demand is positively correlated to the price. So if you try to put the two together and do economic analysis of the silver market, you get gibberish. But if you segregate them and say, this is fabrication demand, this is how it interacts with the price, and this is investment demand, and this is how it interacts with the price, then you have useful analysis. So that's why we segregate investment demand from fabrication demand. And that's why every other commodity, I mean, it's great because you can go to a bank and they'll have a commodities book and they will have all these different commodities, base metals, oil, gas, wheat, corn, cocoa, and they have supply compared to fabrication demand, or in the case of many of these non-metallic commodities, consumption demand. Then they get to gold and silver. And they throw in investment demand. And the only reason they do that is because they use the free data that the World Gold Council and the Silver Institute make available to them.
Look, Jeff, I feel like sometimes people get too in the weeds on this. From just an investing standpoint, I think we need to look at what price is doing. And I do understand how some of these, as you said, fabrication demand, inversely correlated to price, while investment demand, it's way more correlated to price, which actually makes sense. The more investors we have in the sector that are buying on top of the ones selling, that makes sense to me that price would rise. I guess another angle to look at this, just simply from investor demand outside of just the physical, is this ETF demand. While it does tie in a little bit to the physical, this is all investment demand. And last year, all I was reading about was how demand for the physical ETFs, metal ETFs, and also the stock ETFs for precious metals, those were at historic all-time highs, some of them, because of how much investment was coming in. And a lot of that investment was coming in the US from North American investors. What are we seeing this year? Has there been a switch in the ETF demand and the buying that's come in there?
It's been very mixed. It's an interesting situation what you've seen. You did see a surge in gold ETF buying late last year, after August, really. September through December was when you saw this big surge. And that has continued, but at a much slower pace. And you have seen two-way buying and selling of gold ETFs. With silver, it was interesting because in January, as the prices were rising through January, gold ETF holdings were rising sharply, but silver ETF holdings were falling. Investors were selling silver ETFs as the price rose to $121 an ounce. Since that time, in February, March, and the first half of April, it's been more of a mixed bag, and you've seen investors starting to buy silver ETFs on a net basis again. But the pace of demand has slowed for both of the metals ETFs since compared to the last 4 months of last year.
Well, Jeff, another thing we've seen as far as supply and demand is what's happening with the central banks. A couple notable news stories lately were Turkey, what it was doing, but I think it was misrepresented in the sense that with Turkey, it was trying to shore up its own currency and dealing with some of the geopolitical events in the Middle East. And the other central bank that's really picked up a lot of notice has been what France did. And again, I think it was presented as a negative, but I think what they were actually doing was an accounting and repatriation of the gold. So maybe unpack those central bank buying like as a general trend and then in specific Turkey and France.
Okay. On a general trend, central banks bought about 10 million ounces last year, And our projection is that they're likely to buy about 10 million ounces again this year. There are some estimates that they were buying 27 and 32 million ounces, but again, that is inaccurate. And we're not quite sure what, where, and why the errors are occurring in those numbers. To be nice, we think that they may be adding sovereign wealth funds to their central banks. And sovereign wealth funds are not central banks. Central banks buy and hold gold indefinitely against needing them the gold, needing to use the gold to defend the economy or the currency, as you said with Turkey. So they buy gold as a monetary reserve asset. Sovereign wealth funds, it buy gold as an investment. And they will say, I'm buying this with the assumption that within 1 to 5 years, I will be selling it and hopefully taking profits. So you have to exclude the sovereign wealth funds. It could be nice and say that the errors are due to that mistake. But, central banks, bottom line, they have been buying about 10 million ounces a year on average for close to 20 years now, about 18 years, and they are continuing to do that. France didn't necessarily buy gold. What they did is they swapped gold. They had about 4 million ounces of gold in the New York Fed. And this is gold that they had accumulated in New York during the Bretton Woods gold system, gold dollar standard. You would settle your international trade and capital flows with dollars and gold. And they were accumulating a lot of dollars because Americans were net importers of French goods in the 50s and 60s into 1971. And they would take those dollars to the Treasury and say, you say that the gold price is $35 an ounce. Here are my dollars. Give me your gold. Deposit the gold at the New York Fed. And much of the gold that was accumulated at the Fed, this is true from the Bundesbank 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and with the Banque de France, a lot of the gold that was accumulated at the Fed was the 54 million ounces of coin gold, some of the 54 million ounces of coin gold. This is gold that was in US gold coins in circulation prior to 1933. 90% gold, 10% copper. 1933, the US government said, turn in your gold coins. We got to, get some dollars into the economy to get us out of the depression. And they melted this down. They didn't de-alloy it because they assumed that they would be minting gold coins again. They never did mint circulating gold coins, but they had all this gold in gold coin bars, 400-ounce bars of 90% gold. The French had gold in the New York Fed, about 4 million ounces. And they made a decision last year, given the nasty hostility that they were seeing from the Trump administration about the French government and about NATO and about Europe. The French, the Banque de France, made the decision to move that gold from New York to Paris, get it out of the United States, given the Trump administration's attitudes towards France and Europe. So they had 90% gold in New York at the Fed where you can't lend it to other people. And they basically took that gold and sold it and swapped it for good delivery gold, 99.5% gold, delivered into Paris. And they probably spent about $10 million, maybe more, in doing that swap, getting the metal to good delivery standard and getting it out of New York into Europe. So it was probably about a $10 million deal to move that 4 million ounces to Paris. Now, at the Fed recorded and accounted for the gold that it held for foreign account at $42.22 an ounce, the price in early 1971, 73, after we went off the dollar gold standard. From an accounting perspective, central banks agreed that the price wouldn't be $35 an ounce, it would be $42.22. So that gold was on the books at $42.22, and it was 90% gold at the Fed. When they moved the gold, when they swapped the gold, they didn't move it. They sold the 90% stuff in the United States. They bought good delivery for delivery into Paris. And this occurred basically between December and March of this year. When they did that on an accounting basis, they revalued it from $42.22 an ounce to the market or near market price. A lot of central banks will use 80% of the market value because they don't want the monetary value of their gold reserves to fluctuate with the market. But they revalued it. That caused an increase in their balance sheet of about 11 billion euros, about $14 billion US dollars, right? So on an accounting basis, they increased their monetary reserves by that amount. They knew what the real value of that gold was. They knew it wasn't $42 an ounce. They didn't make 11 billion euros in that transaction, but on an accounting basis, it was marked to market and their monetary reserves went up 11 billion. So that's what the French did. It wasn't a negative for the gold market. It was a negative for US-European relations. The Turkish government's done something else, and it's not so much a matter of defending their currency, as some people thought. It was more a matter of supplying liquidity to the Turkish gold market and to generate money to pay for imports. Turkey, the central bank of the Republic of Turkey, generally speaking, has about 60 or 70% of its monetary reserves in gold these days. And they have seen a sharp increase in imports, not only for Turkey, but also for countries that they re-export to, including Russia. And so they have had a run on their currencies, mostly the US dollar and euro. And so they needed to generate some revenue to pay so that they could give dollars and euros to import companies to pay for the imports. That was it. The second part of it, and they actually have been doing this for months. So it wasn't like, oh, once the United States invaded Iran, this happened. The Turkish Central Bank has been selling gold in January and in February of this year. In March, when Dubai shut down, that put an increased pressure on the Istanbul gold market. Dubai and Istanbul were the two big gold trading centers for the Islamic world, all the way from Morocco to Indonesia, as well as for South Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Southeast Asia. So when the Dubai airport closed, the supply flow of gold into South Asia and into Islamic countries throughout the world dried up. And the onus fell on Turkey and the Turkish gold market to have enough gold to meet that demand. So the gold market in the Middle East was rewired from Dubai to Turkey, at least on a temporary basis. And that put pressure for increased amounts of gold in the Turkish market. So in March, the Turkish Central Bank sold, I believe it was like another 930. In March, they sold, I believe, 972,000 ounces. They had sold 1.7 million ounces in the previous 2 months. And then they also swapped some gold for dollars, A, to increase the dollars that they had to meet the dollar and euro demand in the Turkish economy to pay for imports, but also to supply additional gold into the Turkish market during the US and Israeli attack on Iran. So the swaps were made as the idea that we need to supply gold into the Turkish market to meet the increased demand displaced from Dubai. But that's probably going to be like a 3 to 6 month disruption, at which point we'll bring the gold back.
So Jeff, summarize this for me then. Are central banks still buying gold? And I guess even tie in, I feel like the central banks that matter even more, something like China, or even if the US is buying gold. Just broadly summarize this. Central banks, are they buyers or sellers right now?
Central banks continue to buy gold. The higher price means that they're buying somewhat less gold than they otherwise would have bought because they buy in terms of dollar terms, not ounces. The US government is not buying gold. There are rumors that the People's Bank of China is buying gold, but those are simply market rumors at this point. Russia has been selling more gold because it has more severe financial foreign exchange requirements. And so it's been selling more gold. In 6 of the last 8 months, it's been a net seller of gold. Other central banks are buying gold. The French didn't really buy gold. They simply got it out of the United States and into Paris. And the Turkish Central Bank has been trying to help the Turkish gold market take care of the gold market throughout the Middle East and Asia in the absence or in the interruptions that have been occurred in Dubai. But central banks are buying gold, probably around 10 million ounces a year again this year.
All right, perfect. Thanks for summarizing that, Jeff. Overall, this market is still fairly strong, it seems like, but yes, very much range bound, and unfortunately isn't showing more the market outperformance that we saw last year. And that's why even the generalists that we've talked to still have some positions in precious metals, but nowhere near what they had last year as the market was continuing to rip higher. Breakouts would definitely help that, but boy, oh boy, Jeff, you and a lot of our other guests are also really predicting a consolidation, a choppy sideways consolidation for months, if not the rest of this year. We'll see how it all plays out. We're out of time here. So again, that's Jeff Christian, Managing Partner at the CPM Group. Jeff, thanks for joining us. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back. Time to switch our focus to the energy sector.
Al Corlin's firm, AB Corlin and Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.